Hi, I'm Keegan.
And I'm Madigan.
And you're listening to
Your Angry Neighborhood Feminist. This is a podcast where we explore the world through our own personal feminist perspectives.
Hi, welcome back
to another episode in Black History Month.
Yeah!
Yay!
We so love excited. Black History Month. Yes. So this week we are going to be talking about the marches from Selma to Montgomery.
And specifically the movie Selma.
And the movie Selma. Yeah. Yes, which I did not rewatch for this episode. I thought about it. But it has been a crazy week, guys. It has been an insane week. I'm getting ready to start a new job. I have my live show coming up, which will be in the past when this episode comes out.
Yep.
So it's just been a lot, and I didn't have an opportunity to rewatch, but I did watch it when it came out. I've seen it a couple of times.
You're good. I had never seen it.
Yeah?
I can't believe I've never seen it.
That's crazy.
I know. I'm the worst when it comes to watching movies. I've tried for years to watch every movie that's nominated for Best Picture.
It's
really hard to do, and I've never once done it, and it kind of, like, happens by chance. Like, I'm invited to the movies, or a friend gives me a screener, or it's, like, it's one of those things
where... But you know what? Like, TBH, they're not always going to be, like, your cup of tea anyway.
Right. So it's like... Exactly. But Selma totally would have been. Like, I totally would have seen it at the time. I don't know why I didn't see it. I'm also just, like, at home, I'm typically, like, I'd rather watch a TV show than a movie.
I'm the same.
You know? So...
I have a ton of commitment issues
with movies.
Same. Like, I have almost all of the Oscar-nominated movies, like, either by screener or on digital from my job. Like, I have so many movies right now.
Yeah.
And when I'm home alone, do I watch them?
No.
No, I don't.
You watch the same thing you've seen a million times.
Yeah, I watch New Girl or, you know.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm really glad that I got to see it today. You know, growing up, I did learn about this march, but there was really a lot about it that I didn't know. There were a lot of people that were in, like, characters in the movie that I didn't know a whole lot about that had me pulling out my phone and looking at different things. And so that was something for me that I really liked, was that it was a really, like, educational thing for me.
Like I said, I grew up watching Selma, Lord Selma, the Wonderful World of Disney movie starring Journey Smollett.
Yeah.
So, for me, I had...
You had knowledge going into it.
Knowledge of this. I brought... Okay, so guys, back in the day, if you're a youngin', you will not remember this, but back in the day, if you wanted to record something before TiVo, you would actually go to Walgreens and buy...
A blank tape.
VHS tapes, and you could... There was a record button on your VCR. Mm-hmm. So I did that with this movie, and your skills were to, like, sit by the VCR and hit record... Whenever it was going and hit stop right before a commercial.
The commercials, yeah.
And you wanted to get like...
I always just kind of let it play.
Oh, I never did. I was like, I'm going to get these commercials.
It's fun for me because, okay, so you know...
Oh, now it is.
You know my obsession with Anne Frank. I recorded the Anne Frank TV movie.
Oh, I had that one too.
Yeah, and I watched it when I was like in high school, and it was so much fun to watch the old commercials.
Nowadays, it's hilarious.
It's
At the time, though, I was like, I don't want to sit through these commercials.
Of course not.
And I thought it was like, you know, you were fucking baller if you could get in and like cut it off and back on like right whenever
there was
it stopped
no editing
and started.
System it just was your pure skill
like pure skill. So I did that with Selma, Lord Selma, and then I brought it in to school at my elementary school for Black History Month, and I was like, let's watch this. Like, we had a whole day where we watched, which you guys know, if you were a kid in the 90s, the
when they pulled
day,
the TV in.
Yes, when they rolled it in on that, like, cart or whatever.
With, like, the red, like, band around it so the TV doesn't wiggle around. Yeah.
Yes, that was the best. So,
The best.
So, I watched that. So, I grew up kind of knowing the story.
I need to watch that movie now.
On a very superficial level. I mean, it's a very, it's for kids.
Yeah.
So,
but
while,
I still like kids movies.
Right.
I'm
so
sure
while,
I still enjoy it.
It's from the perspective of like a 12-year-old. So like, while they do go into things like she does get tear gassed and like things like that, and they do address those things.
Yeah. It's on a more kid-friendly level.
Yeah. I would say watch Selma, Lord Selma and Selma.
Yeah.
Because they give you the same story from kind of like different perspectives.
Yeah.
And then also do a lot of your own reading because both of those are examples of very dramatized.
It's all good.
Versions.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I liked about this movie too, is that whenever there was something I wasn't aware of, I would just pull it up on my phone. I'm one of those people, like, in theaters, I want to look shit up on my phone so bad because I want to know.
Oh, me
especially
too.
If it's, like,
I want to know what they look like.
Story. Yeah, yes. Or I want to know the trivia on IMDb. Yes. Or, like, anything like that. Something. It's so hard for me not to look at my phone, but I also find myself getting distracted. Like, today I was reading stuff. I was like, oh, shit, I got to rewind. I got to start that part over because I missed something or, you know.
Yeah, I'm the same way. I got most of my information from, like, three different sources, one of the major ones being a history.com article. And while I was reading through that, I was like, when names would come up, I would like go and Google to
exactly.
see like what that person looked like.
That's what happens to me whenever we have like a broad topic, like last week with the black suffragettes. Like every mm-hmm. time a name came up, I'm like, okay, I'm gonna
I
want to
see what
way,
this person looks like.
I'm going to be way too far into
yeah,
this.
Yeah.
So let's get started. Do you want to kind of start with like a little bit of background on the march itself, or how do you want to start this?
I kind of wanted to read this first paragraph is directly from the history.com article, but
okay, cool.
I feel like it is a good baseline
yeah.
for us to get started. So,
okay, go for
it says the Selma to Montgomery March was part of a series of civil rights protests that occurred in 1965 in Alabama, a southern state with deeply entrenched racist policies. In March of that year, in an effort to register black voters in the South, protesters marching the 55-mile route from Selma to the state capital of Montgomery were confronted with deadly violence from local authorities and white vigilante groups. Mm-hmm. As the world watched, the protesters, under the protection of federalized National Guard troops, finally achieved their goal, walking around the clock for 3 days to reach Montgomery. The historic march and Martin Luther King Jr.'s participation in it raised awareness of the difficulties faced by black voters and the need for a National Voting Rights Act.
Yeah. Whew. Something that the movie did really well with was the fact that it was very explicit and jarring in its visuals of what it was like to try to register to vote. The opening when it's the bombing at the church. Let me see what the church name was. At the Birmingham church bombing. Mm-hmm. When the four girls are walking down the stairwell and they're talking about, you know, Coretta King's hair. I'm sure that's, you know, purely...
It's dramatized.
Dramatized,
yeah.
You know. But there, it's just like, he just won the Nobel Prize, and then it cuts to them, like, walking down the stairs, and all of a sudden, this explosion. That was jarring.
Right, and I think that the reason why Selma was such a turning point for a lot of people, specifically a lot of white Americans, is because the same way we could look at the 90s growing up, or a lot of people even now, I mean, look, we just turned comments off on one of our posts today
yeah.
because I think a lot of people are just like, racism doesn't exist anymore because yeah. they're living in this bubble.
Well, and it also it's not even just that racism doesn't exist anymore. It's also saying that we can't be quote-unquote blamed for what our ancestors did.
Right, which is a whole other like topic. Yeah. But I think the reason why Selma was so jarring for people is because Martin Luther King Jr. had just won the Nobel Peace Prize. People, I think, thought, especially people in the North, progressives, white progressives, who weren't living in the South.
I mean, even probably white people in the South, like, didn't want to give him credit for it, but, like, didn't really realize the threat, necessarily.
I mean, I don't know. I have a hard time believing that in the Deep South, because it was happening very frequently all
yeah,
the time.
Yeah, that's true. Probably just angered
so,
them.
I don't know about in the South.
And I didn't mean ignorance. I meant more like, you have what you want, so why are you asking for more kind of thing?
I mean, possibly.
That's kind of what the governor said in one of the speeches.
Well, they wanted a separate... They just wanted a separate society. Like,
yeah.
they were very anti-desegregation
yeah.
and all of that. But I think what it was with Selma, like, the point I'm trying to make is that it was very jarring because this was the first time, and we're going to get to that a little later on, where this kind of brutality on this massive scale was being televised
yeah.
for everyone to see. And it really removed the idea of complacency for progressive white people in the North. Like,
yeah.
they weren't able to sit very comfortably in their living rooms and say, it can't be that bad,
they
I'm sure it's fine.
They yeah. show the people watching it on the news.
Yes, and because it's something very real that happened,
yeah.
their numbers grew astronomically after Bloody Sunday.
Yeah.
Because white people, particularly social rights activists and pastors and rabbis,
yeah.
people of the church, they could no longer sit comfortably in their living rooms and think that nothing really that bad was happening because
yeah.
they were watching it happen.
Yeah.
And
this is around the same time as, like, the Vietnam War, where that was being televised and people were so angered by that too. That was a really big year for television in general with that kind of stuff, you know, and having like this mass news coverage that people weren't used to.
But to see it happening in your country and to see it happening to people who were being completely passive and who were unarmed, which was a huge part of their strategy, which was like they can't fight back because if they fight back, we've seen what happens. Even today, if Black people show any resistance, they're asking for it. So their strategy was, we're not going to show any resistance. We're still going to put ourselves in danger, get hurt, possibly die.
The first, like, protest that we see in the movie where they go to, like, the town hall, and, like, the thing that was so beautiful visually and audibly about the movie was that it was so quiet. You know, they were completely peaceful. They're walking peacefully to this, like, town hall, and they all kneel down and they put their hands on their heads. And it was such a, like, moving image, even from the beginning of the movie, that was really effective, I thought.
Yeah.
And then, like, the guy doesn't, like, sit down, and Oprah just, like, fucking smacks the shit. That was Oprah, right?
Yeah, Oprah was...
Oprah just, like, smacks
Oprah the... Oprah played a real person who I'll get to a little later. But, so let's give a little, like, background on where we got, like, how we got to this place.
Yes.
So in 1964, the Civil Rights Act passed, and it forbade discrimination in voting on the basis of race.
Yeah, and public facilities.
However, Southern states really didn't adhere to that, particularly any state that really participated in Jim Crow was not trying to participate in equal...
Jim Crow laws were very much still in effect. And what we talked about last week, too, with, like, you can vote, but we're going to make it nearly impossible for you to
do it. Well, and yeah, and that's exactly what sparked this entire movement.
Yeah.
So they were putting some tactics into place, particularly for... I'm going to stop saying particularly because I say it so much.
Oh, I didn't even realize.
I say it so much. When I'm editing, I'm like, wow. but they put in a lot of tactics specifically for Black voters to try and keep them from voting. And some of these things were a poll tax, where a lot of Black voters were not able to pay that in order to vote.
I like that they had somebody actually explain that in the movie as well, because they're all kind of shushing him. He's like, no, 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 hear me out. And he kind of, like, walks you through what that means.
Right.
And I really appreciated that.
Yeah, yeah, which is really helpful. And that's something that Ava... DuVernay, is that how you say her last
name? So.
That is something that she does really well, which is to at once entertain and educate at the same time without it feeling disruptive.
Yeah.
So there were poll taxes in place. There were literacy tests in place. That was one of the biggest ones.
Yeah.
Which said that if you couldn't read, you couldn't vote. And you're talking about a time where a lot, specifically older Black
weren't allowed
people
to go to school.
Weren't granted that kind of education.
Yeah.
So.
I don't know her name, the character name. I'm horrible at remembering them. So when Oprah was trying to vote and they're asking all these questions, she's killing it. She's answering these questions that I wouldn't know the answers to. I'm like, I don't know.
Yeah, like constitutional questions.
Yeah,
and
then they're like, well, what are the names of these people? And she doesn't know. And it's just this big stamp denied. And it's just like, it's so heartbreaking.
Right. And those aren't really exaggerations. Like, those are things that actually happened.
Yeah.
And beyond those things that should happen, you know, when you went to register to vote, there was also just straight up intimidation by, you know, KKK members or just white supremacy groups to stop you from voting, really threatening your life, your family's lives, and then straight up fraud, where they, if you did vote, they, you know...
They didn't cast it.
They didn't cast
matter,
it.
Yeah.
So at this time, only 2% of Selma's eligible Black voters, so that's about 300 out of 1,500 people in Selma, had managed to register to vote.
They mentioned that in the movie, too.
Yeah, which is crazy.
Yeah.
So in 1965, Martin Luther King Jr. joined up with the Southern Christian Leadership Council, or the SCLC, to make Selma, Alabama the focus for the voter registration campaign. So they called him, I think John Lewis was a member of the SCLC.
I think John Lewis was a member of...
was he a member of a different organization?
He was a member of SNCC.
Okay, sorry. Well, they called him up and they were like, you just won the Nobel Peace Prize. Wow. You just won the Nobel Peace Prize. We could really use someone like you here in Selma, Alabama.
It could have been Reverend Hosea Williams.
Could have been.
He was, because him and John Lewis were the ones that led
the march.
Bloody Sunday.
Yeah. 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 And so King agreed to come down. He actually called the president and was like, I am going to make Selma my focus point for this voting campaign.
That was a weird thing for me to witness because I had a lot of, like, animosity and, like, animosity? Not animosity. I had a lot of, like, anger toward the president during the first scene that they showed him.
Animosity works.
Animosity, yeah, sure. Okay. I just didn't know if that sounded weird in this context. Where I was kind of like, fuck you, man. Like, he just kind of came off as a dick to me, but
I think fuck you, man, regardless, despite what he's going to do at the end of this podcast,
yeah,
I think fuck you, man, is a totally okay stance to have.
Good. Yeah, because he starts being more and more, like, on board as it goes on, but you totally see a politician who is worried about, like, not offending people and
absolutely
wanting to make everybody happy and mm-hmm things like that. But then you meet the governor and you're like, no, actually, fuck this dude.
Yes.
In particular,
yes,
fuck this dude.
So you the know? Governor of Alabama was Governor George Wallace, and he was a racist as fuck, as you can imagine for any politician in Georgia in 1965. But he was a huge opponent to desegregation, as was the sheriff of Selma at the time. And
they were
massively.
Did you know that originally, before the, I can't remember how to say her last name, Ava Dur.
We know who you're talking about.
Okay.
Yeah, the director of Selma.
The director of Selma. There was another one. There was somebody
DuVernay,
else who was
going
to be directing before her. And they wanted Robert De Niro, I think, to be the sheriff. They wanted Liam Neeson, I want to say. I didn't write this down.
To be the governor?
Maybe. It was something like, it was like a lot of really big names, but I like that they kind of made them unnamed people. But yo, the cast is dope. Like,
yeah, the cast is so good.
Oh god, just when you think you've seen everybody, like Cuba Gooding Jr. comes in and you're like, yes, then Martin Sheen comes
in
and you're like,
everyone
yes
wanted to be involved because it was such a massively incredible project.
Yeah, for real.
But the sheriff of Selma at the time and the governor as well were also opposed to any black voter registration drives.
Yeah.
So they would go in and break up any registration drives that were happening at the time because the SCLC, the Southern Christian Leadership Council, as well as the one that you mentioned, they both planned lots of drives to try and get black folks voted after the Civil Rights Act passed because they were like, this is our chance. They can no longer discriminate by race, but they found illegal ways of being able to do it.
So the state trooper that we're talking about is Corporal James. Oh no, sorry, that's the wrong one. Where is it? Just to get
the county sheriff is Jim Clark. So, we're about to get into the events that really led up to the decision to do this march. So, Martin Luther King Jr. had already come into Alabama, had come into Selma and said, like, we're going to do, I'm going to make this the focal point for my voter registration.
Mm-hmm.
And, but then there were, like, a lot of things that led up to actually deciding to do a 54-mile march from Selma to Montgomery.
Yeah.
So, on February 18th, 1965, a group of white segregationists and state troopers attacked a peaceful protest, and a young black man named Jimmie Lee Jackson was beaten and eventually shot to death.
So, the leader of that march was C.T. Vivian, and they led the march to the courthouse in Marion to protest the arrest of James Orange, is what I was reading online, which was also a lead-up to all of these things. So, the state officials were given orders to target Vivian, and a line of Alabama state troopers waited for the marchers at Perry County Courthouse. They also had all the lights shut off. They made it very intimidating for them because they knew it was going to be happening. And Jimmie Lee Jackson and his mother fled the scene. They went into a cafe and they came in and beat both of them and shot Jimmy. And the officer, who is State Trooper Corporal James Bonnard Fowler, wow, long name, says that, and this is going to ring so true to today, he claims that Jimmy was trying to get his gun as they grappled.
Which makes no sense.
That's everything you hear from any shooting of a black person these days. They're like, oh, but we didn't know if he was
right. It's armed. Straight out of the James Bonnard playbook.
It is.
Right?
Like, it is.
So in response to Jackson's death, that is really what sparked the 55-mile march from Selma to the state capitol, and that's what made them start planning this march.
Yeah.
So a group of 600 people set out from Selma on Sunday, March 7th, 1965. Mm-hmm. So this is the day that was later dubbed Bloody Sunday. This is what you're going to see a lot of if you watched the trailer but didn't watch the movie for Selma.
Yeah.
And you see some of that violence going down. This is probably what you saw. And it's not to say that there wasn't violence leading up to it. Clearly there was with the death of Jimmie Lee Jackson.
This was heavily, heavily televised as well. So there's a lot of footage that shows what actually happened. So they were heading southeast out of Selma on U.S. Highway 80. It was led by John Lewis of SNCC and Reverend Hosea Williams of SCLC. And something I found interesting was that John Lewis was like a chairman of SNCC, and then there was the other guy that he worked with, who was James something. And he, I don't know if this actually happened, but in the movie, the other guy was like, if you march with them, you will not march as part of this corporation.
Oh, yeah. I think that is what happened. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I found that to be a really beautiful thing, that he was willing to, like, put his faith in really what he believed in, and mm-hmm. not just because he has to remain loyal to a certain
corporation.
Or anything like that. Not corporation. You know what I mean?
Right. Organization.
Organization. Thank you. Mm-hmm. So it was led by John Lewis and Reverend Hosea Williams. The protests went according to plan until the marchers crossed the Edmund Pettus Bridge, where they encountered a wall of state troopers and a county posse waiting for them. So it was like a bunch of white folk with Confederate flags.
Right. And this should be, there's a note on this, which is that the morning of the march, County Sheriff Jim Clark.
That's what I was just gonna say, yo.
Yeah, he instructed every able-bodied white man over the age of 25 to go to the courthouse to be deputized.
Oh, I read 21. I read over the age of 21.
Mine said 25. Okay. To go to the courthouse to be deputized.
Yeah.
And so they had massive manpower because it wasn't just state troopers. It wasn't just police officers. It was a lot of local people who they had set out, like, they set out to overpower this crowd.
They did.
Of 600. And they set out to do it with hateful white people. Like, it wasn't about the law.
No.
Don't let anybody try and tell you that they were breaking the law or it was anything like that, and that's why they did this.
Yeah. They didn't do anything.
They didn't do
anything. They're walking across a bridge. Mm-hmm. Like, come on now. Commander Officer John Cloud told the demonstrators to disband and go home, and when Reverend Williams tried to speak to the officer, Cloud said that there was nothing to discuss, and the troopers began shoving, beating with nightsticks, fired tear gas, and mounted troops charged on horseback. It really is a scene to witness, especially for me, like, the ones that are on horseback and everything. It's just complete chaos.
It's chaos, and I have a video that I sent to you earlier that we're going to put on our Instagram as kind of like a teaser for this episode, so it should be up by the time this episode comes out, so you can go to our Instagram and watch it. But you see, it's very jarring because it is, I think it mirrors the movie very well in that it seems to be fairly quiet. Like, you can see them talking to each other. The crowd comes up to the state troopers. You see them talking to each other, and then chaos. And then, like, screaming. And then, like, people getting trampled. So that's what happens next.
Yeah, and I like what they did in the movie where they had somebody in, like, a phone booth, like a reporter, who's kind of explaining what's happening as it's happening in a really, like, you know, journalistic, poetic kind of way.
Right.
I really, really liked a lot of the choices they made for that movie.
Yeah,
that
the movie really is beautiful. Like, if you guys have not seen it, it's heartbreaking. It'll probably make you cry.
Yeah.
But it is such an incredible movie.
Yeah.
And I can't believe she wasn't nominated for Best Director that year for that movie. That's crazy.
My God.
But the scene was completely captured on camera, as we said, and it was kind of one of the first times that it was brought into the living room of the everyday, average, middle-of-the-road, maybe moderate or progressive white American.
Yeah, and it brought, like you said, it brought the Selma voting rights campaign to a new heights. It really did. And especially because Martin Luther King Jr. made a speech talking about calling for the clergy to stand in solidarity. And so, you know, they say in the movie there was a man who was just saying, like, you know, I couldn't deny it. He called for us. I saw what happened. There's no way I could have stayed home and not been a part of it.
Right. It's very hard to have that kind of, like, cognitive dissonance where you can trick your mind or do whatever mental gymnastics you need to do to think that this isn't a problem mm-hmm. whenever you are seeing it being a problem right in front of your face, and whenever somebody who is respected, like Martin Luther King Jr.,
is asking
for that. And yeah. I also, eventually, maybe not this year for Black History Month, but eventually I think we do need to have an episode talking about Martin Luther King Jr. because I think yeah. people have a lot of misconceptions about him being this beloved figure by white people, and he was not.
No, he was
disliked by 80% of white people at the time of yeah. his death. But one protester in particular, and this is the woman who I think, if Oprah wasn't directly emulating, she...
No, the woman that you're thinking of, the one that got knocked unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
It's not Oprah.
It's not Oprah?
No, they look very, because they're dressed very similarly. It's the girl that played the villain in Orange is the New Black season 3. What's her name?
Oh, that's very specific, and I don't know.
I'm sorry. It's, oh, God, hold on.
Well, pause. But the protesters...
Oh, Lorraine Toussaint. She played Amelia Boynton.
Yes. So the protester's name was Amelia Boynton. She yeah. was in her 50s. At the time, and she was beaten unconscious, and her photo of her laying in the street was on the front page of newspapers across the country.
Yeah.
And you can find this photo if you Google her name. You can find lots of photos. I mean,
yeah.
men carrying her yeah. unconscious in the street. And I think seeing this kind of older woman
yeah.
who was marching peacefully, completely knocked unconscious, and I think seeing all of these other bloodied, battered, beaten bodies,
it humanizes it so much, I think, to the people who wanted to not see it.
And
as
there's literally
people.
Nothing you can say either, because yeah. they weren't being violent. It's all captured on film. They
yeah.
didn't do anything to deserve this level of violence.
Exactly.
It really acted as a mirror, I think, in a lot of ways for mm-hmm. white people in the country to take a look at themselves
yeah.
and say, you know, you need to step on one side of history or the other.
Exactly.
Like, which side are you going to be
and
on?
And a lot of the speeches that are given in the film is Martin Luther King talking about both the white Americans and Black Americans taking a backseat and not doing something about it, and how they are part of the problem because of it. And I think that is so poignant to what's going on today, where if you're choosing to be passive, then you're part of the problem.
Right.
You know, you do what you can. You know, you don't all have to be these crazy activists. You know, we all have our lives and we all have different ways of activism, but I think that making that a point that if you're not a part of the change, you're part of the problem,
right.
is really important.
Bare minimum, just being vocal about yeah. your beliefs.
Exactly. Or or like when you hear somebody say something, say something in response. Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
I think that
don't let it just go by.
Those tiny little forms of activism are the things that help change the world around, like move
yeah.
the world around. Like, that's what we need.
Yeah, it's a chain reaction.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know? So, because of Martin Luther King's call to action for clergy, hundreds of rabbis and priests and social activists fled to Selma to join
and
the
nuns.
Movement. Nuns,
Alexi
yes.
and
there's
the nuns.
Tons of nuns marching. Lots of white people, really.
Yeah.
Marching.
That one woman at the end of the movie, they say that while she was like driving some of the Black protesters back, got killed. Which I wish they would have, like, shown that a
elaborated
bit.
On that.
Yeah, because,
more.
Like, I want to know more about her.
That would be something interesting to explore. I'd be interested to explore that further.
Yeah,
you
I'm gonna write her name down, and maybe
yeah.
we can do maybe I'll, like, do her for, like, a forgotten feminist
yeah,
babe or something.
Yeah, absolutely, because I would love to know more about her.
Because that is something that I like, too, is that they did show what allyship looks like and how to be a good ally, because I feel
like
there's a lot of people that want to be allies but don't really know how to do it, so they just take a backseat.
It was very interesting doing research for this episode, because really looking at this movement and this march, this time that really spanned from February through the end of March, beginning of February through the end of March, this movement that happened, it was fascinating because it kind of illustrated so many different aspects
mm-hmm.
of allyship and, you know, a lot of things that I think we experience today in regards to, like, racism. It
yeah.
really highlighted a lot of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So on March 9th, King led more than 2,000 marchers, black and white, across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, but found Highway 80 to be blocked again by state troopers. And then he paused the marchers and he led them in prayer. And I believe, and I could be wrong about this, this is where they got on their knees all together.
They showed it in the beginning of the movie.
It may have happened a couple times,
yeah.
possibly. And when he led them in prayer, the troopers stepped aside. But King turned the protesters back around. Like, I think he just didn't trust it. He didn't believe that the troopers were trying to create an opportunity that would allow them to enforce. So there was a federal injunction that was prohibiting.
Well, what I read was that Turnaround Tuesday, which I believe is what you're discussing.
Yes.
That to prevent another outbreak of violence, the SCLC attempted to gain a court order that would prohibit the police from interfering. That's what I read. So
sorry, this is a mess because I wrote my notes really weirdly.
Yeah, so it says, instead of issuing a court order, Federal District Court Judge Frank Minnis Johnson issued a restraining order prohibiting the march from taking place until he could hold additional hearings later in the week. Which they don't, they show the hearing in the movie and they show good old Martin Sheen being like, yeah, you'll be protected, is from what I got from the movie. That
yeah, I think it was pretty unclear, and I think that's why Martin Luther King decided to turn around, because he was just like,
you don't know what people are going to do either
if I proceed forward, if we're going to have another Bloody Sunday. And I think he was trying to avoid that, but he received so much criticism
for turning them
for
around.
Doing that. Like, they called him cowardly. They said that it weakened the movement.
Yeah.
I mean,
there,
not
there have
forward.
Been so many deaths that I understand his trepidation.
Absolutely. I do too. I do
I
too. I understand it from both perspectives, because I also get why you would feel
totally
like, no, we need to just push forward.
Yeah, what are you doing? Yeah, and I can see where he wouldn't believe that they weren't going to do something anyways, because they, like, what Martin Luther King and his, like, followers were doing, they were risking arrest. They were risking all these things. Maybe the white people are going to risk that same thing for what they
believe.
Well,
and they were risking,
you know,
death. And you're in Alabama, and
the white person is not going to get thrown away
if you're more likely to die in this scenario. Absolutely. And to illustrate that, on that same night, so March 9th, a group of segregationists attacked another protester who was a young white minister named James Reeb, and they beat him to death.
Yeah, and then in the movie, it's like, this is what it feels like to be a black man, basically.
Yes.
They used harsher language than that.
Which
I'm not gonna use their language.
I appreciate. I appreciate that they even demonstrated that in the movie, because, okay, so I'm going to walk a line here. Obviously and very clearly, this was a tragedy, and I think that even, of course, like, black folks at the time in the South, in this movement, thought that it was a tragedy, and they were heartbroken about it, and he was there for them, and that meant a lot.
Yeah.
However, there was such a huge national outcry after James Reeb's death. So
that
much so,
differed
yeah, so
from
much
the other
so
deaths.
That the president called James Reeb's widow.
Yeah.
And it sparked this national outrage, which was great for the movement, but there
they
were.
Did, but
they
you
didn't
know,
do
but
that.
Jimmy Lee Jackson did
exactly.
not have the same response.
Exactly. Yeah. And so there was this stark difference where it just like, it seemed like, okay, this is what we mean when we say Black Lives Matter.
Yeah.
Because the life of this one white man was. It so outweighed the lives that had already been lost, and the fact that someone who was of a comparable age, but the only difference was he was black and local rather than white and a northerner, had lost his life as well, and it didn't seem to matter as much.
Yeah. So SNCC organizer Stokely Carmichael argued that the movement itself is playing into the hands of racism, because what you want as a nation is to be upset when anybody is killed, but for it to be recognized, a white person must be killed. Well, what are you saying?
Yeah, exactly. It means that our lives don't matter as much.
Mm-hmm.
And to get traction on this movement, white people needed to get hurt.
Yeah.
And, of course, I'm not trying to diminish in any
anybody's
way.
Death.
Absolutely. And also, like, James Reeb didn't need to go down there. He was a comfortable white northerner. He didn't need to put himself in that kind of risk.
Yeah.
He did
what
as an ally.
What he did was brave, but also what every single other black person in Alabama did all the time to protest to get what they wanted and deserved.
To just live their lives.
To live their lives the same as any other white person in the world. Their deaths mean just as much.
Exactly, yeah. And they deserved calls. Their families deserved calls from the
100%.
President, too, you know?
Yeah.
So Alabama state officials led by Wallace tried to prevent the march from going forward, mm-hmm. but a U.S. district court judge ordered them to permit the march at this point, kind of as a result of this national outcry from the death of James Reeb.
Yeah, they're like, now you have to do it.
Yeah, James Reeb, not James Reebs. So 6 days later, on March 15th, President Lyndon B. Johnson went on the national television to pledge his support to the Selma protesters and to call for the passage of a new voting rights bill that he has introduced into Congress. And this was a big deal. He had started the ball rolling on introducing this bill to Congress, actually, before James Reeb's death. But after James Reeb's death is whenever he finally decided. And that's the thing about Lyndon B. Johnson where I'm just like, yes, thank you for passing the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act.
But he was very much pressured into it. And you see that in the movie, too, with his kind of, like...
He didn't want to rock the boat.
Well, and he was saying, too, like, there's a lot of things that are on my plate. He's like, you have this one cause, I have all of these. You know what I mean?
Which I can appreciate.
Appreciate it. All good.
However...
But at the same time, it's like, that's what politicians do. They're not going to make a move for change in a positive direction until they are directly affected by it in some way. And I feel like that's how a lot of people are, too. They don't realize that there's an issue until they are somehow affected by it.
Right.
And then they care.
It took Lyndon B. Johnson feeling direct pressure from the country to do any sort of movement. Yeah. So he did finally address the country, and he has a very famous quote where he says, "There is no Negro problem.
Yeah.
There is no Southern problem. There is no Northern problem. There is only an American problem. Their cause must be our cause, too, because it is not just Negroes, but really it is all of us who must overcome the crippling legacy of bigotry and injustice, and we shall overcome." Which, again, I appreciate, but I'm also like, there's something so pandering about using the words from an old Negro spiritual, "we shall overcome," in your speech.
That's really weird.
Where I feel like you're pandering to black audiences in a way that I'm like, I don't know, maybe I'm being too picky and judgy.
No, I completely read it the same way.
Yeah, but I was
read
just
it the
like,
same way too.
All right, I get it.
Little, can I tell like short sidebar story from childhood? So when I was in fifth grade, every year the fifth graders during Black History Month, I feel like I might have talked about this.
I think you did. Where they did "We Have a Dream."
We Have a Dream, and then afterwards we sang "We Shall Overcome."
Mm-hmm.
And I went to a very white populated school in elementary school, and I had a friend Zanetta who was one of the only Black children in my class, along with a few others. And I just remember looking over at her mom, who was bawling. Like, not like her body wasn't moving. There was nothing. She wasn't sobbing, but you could just see tears streaming down her face of just pride, like in her daughter being a part of that.
Yeah. I mean, and I've also heard stories of, this is why I don't want to trivialize what Lyndon B. Johnson did, because.
No, but I do. I read it the same way.
Right.
When I heard
I think with distance and us being from a different generation, we can read it that way.
Mm-hmm.
But I also have read stories of Black people at the time, including Martin Luther King Jr., who, when they watched this
they felt seen.
They felt seen, and they did cry. Like, there's documentation of people who were there with Martin Luther King Jr. who saw him cry when he watched this, because it was like, finally, like, you are addressing this, and you're not addressing it.
Yeah, it's almost kind of like a wink and a nod to that at the same time.
And you're not addressing it in some kind of, like, underhanded terms or covering it up with a bunch of different language. You're saying explicitly, this is a problem.
Yeah.
Racism is a problem. We have a crippling, disgusting history that needs to be looked at. Like, this specifically needs to be looked
at. And I think it can be both at the same time. I think that both ways that you can read it are accurate.
Yeah, agreed.
At the same time.
Agreed. And I totally see that. And I do appreciate Lyndon B. Johnson doing it. I wish he had set out to do that on his own, and it wasn't something he had to be pressured into, but I also appreciate that he did it
sometimes
regardless.
Sometimes you gotta take what you can get, you know?
Absolutely.
I mean, like, that just kind of reminds me how Obama, you know, he wasn't planning on having gay marriage become legal during his presidency.
Right.
And he did it anyways. He did it, and we will always be forever thankful for him
legalizing
it.
And that will be, attributed to him forever.
Exactly.
So some 2,000 people set out from Selma on March 21st, protected by U.S. Army troops and Alabama National Guard forces that Lyndon B. Johnson had ordered under federal control.
Wait, how many did you say?
2,000.
Why is Wikipedia saying 8,000?
I don't know.
They said 8,000 people assembled at Brown Chapel AME Church to commence the trek to Montgomery.
I don't know. Maybe they all didn't march. I got this from history.com.
I mean, your source is much better. I'm just my notes are all over the place, so I'm just following along on Wikipedia.
I'm not saying, listen.
I'm getting my timeline from them. Okay.
If you have the correct number, email us.
Okay, yeah, for real.
Who knows? A lot. I looked at several
8,000
different...
8,000 is a lot.
8,000 seems like a lot.
That's a lot.
I looked at several different sources, and a lot of the information was conflicting. So, I'm not exactly sure.
Yeah.
I went with what I could find the most resources for.
Let's go with 2,000. So, that sounds more correct than 8,000. So, there you go.
But, so, they were protected by U.S. Army troops in the Alabama National Guard. And I believe Lyndon B. Johnson had talked to the governor of Alabama asking him for protection, like, on the state level.
Well, that is a scene in the movie, too.
And he denied it. He was like, I'm not going to do it. So Lyndon B. Johnson had to step in with National Guard forces.
Yes.
And U.S. Army troops. So he brought in national forces rather than it being state forces. And they walked about 12 hours a day. They would sleep in fields along the way. The first night, they slept in a farmer's field. It was a black man who had a farm. And it's so crazy seeing...
I want to read that man's story.
Yeah, yeah. And it's so interesting seeing the footage of this because... I always find it interesting when I'm watching, like when you watch the movie Selma, you see it where it's like women of this time are marching in like dresses and petticoats and like heels. And I'm like, I've been to marches. My feet hurt after marching in my docks all day. So
for
I'm
real.
Like, I can't imagine this. And so seeing them in this field where they're getting ready to stay for the night and these women are like in their dresses, like standing in the middle
in
of
their
fields.
Sunday best.
I'm like, this seems impractical.
Yeah.
Wear some pants.
Yeah.
They finally reached Montgomery on March 25th of that year. So nearly 5,000 supporters, black and white, met the marchers in Montgomery, where they gathered in front of the state capitol to hear King and several others speak, including Ralph Bunche. I don't know. But he was the winner of the 1950 Nobel Peace Prize.
Yeah.
And they addressed the crowd.
Yeah.
King said in his speech, "No tide of racism can stop us," which I can only imagine. Can you imagine walking for 3 days?
Yeah.
54 miles, facing this kind of discrimination, and then getting there and hearing those words from Martin Luther King Jr.
Yeah. Was this from his How Long, Not Long speech?
If it was from the steps of the Capitol after
because he also says, "The end we seek is a society at peace with itself, a society that can live with its conscience. I know you are asking today, how long will it take? I come to say to you this afternoon, however difficult the moment, however frustrating the hour, it will not be long."
Yeah. So while this
cadence with his speeches.
I know.
My God, I'm like...
That's what I was thinking.
Talk me to sleep, and David Oyelowo says it's, like, it does such a beautiful portrayal of, like, his cadence with his speeches. All the speeches he does in the chapels.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh.
You know what I love about David Oyelowo, too, and his, the way that he did Martin Luther King Jr. is that I don't feel like he was trying to do a direct impression.
He wasn't
like,
impersonating
it wasn't an imitation.
No.
It was like his own thing as an actor. Like he
it
made his own choices.
It didn't look too put on.
Right.
Yeah.
He made his own choices. It wasn't a direct impression of him, but he captured the essence so beautifully that I loved it. So I'm going to like backtrack just a tiny bit, but on March 17th, 1965, so while they were gearing up to march, getting ready for the march, Lyndon B. Johnson had already addressed a joint session in Congress calling for a federal Voting Rights Act.
Yeah.
He was calling for voting rights legislation even before they had reached their destination. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to protect African Americans from the barriers that prevented them from voting. So this is a big deal. I mean, you think about the year before this, they had put into action already the Civil Rights Act. So I imagine before Selma, before seeing all of the physical damage that was being done to black Americans in the South, I imagine it was probably pretty easy for white people to be like, we already gave you the Civil Rights Act. Like, we already addressed this problem.
And that's another thing they say in the movie as well. It's like it's that whole what more do you want kind of situation.
Yeah, because it says in the Civil Rights Act that you're allowed to vote. I don't get it. Like, why are you so upset? Why do you need a separate Voting Rights Act to put more limitations on what states are allowed to do?
And I just looked at my notes from watching the movie. And something that was really upsetting to me is the language that was used by the white characters in the movie. Like, you know, we're giving a lot of praise to Lyndon B. Johnson. We are also criticizing him. But there was one line where he's talking to the governor and he says, "Why not just let the N-words vote?" And it's so like he's fighting for them to get their vote, but then he's using this term that's
I think that's probably also dramatized, and I think that that's actually a genius move on the director of Selma, because I think it really, really effectively illustrates that this passivity, like, it effectively illustrates, like, you don't have to be marching in the South, burning crosses with a hood on to
be still be racist.
You can have this insidious...
You can be passing this law and still
and
be racist.
And still be, like, still have this... You can be a president and realize that, you know, you have to do this because you're the president of the United States, but also feel like black people are inferior
and
to you.
And when you're in a room with your, like, fellow white man... And you're using
and you're
a
comfortable.
Word like that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And
it makes a really big statement.
And this is the reason why. And I'm going to, like, hammer it home because I'm feeling particularly raw because our Instagram feed is a goddamn mess.
I couldn't read it anymore. I'm surprised that you kept looking at it because I showed my boyfriend this morning and he was like, "Get that away from me. I can't even look at it."
Yeah, just so you guys know, we've never turned off comments before. No. I have never done it.
Wait, I thought we did for one post.
I don't think we did.
Didn't we turn them off for the Emma Gonzalez post?
No, we didn't.
Okay.
We never turned off comments for that one, even though we were getting bad, like, comments. We've never turned off comments before. We did, because the amount of white fragility in our comments, man, it was really upsetting.
It was sickening.
But this is why I really want to drive home for you. If you are in a room, we said the same thing. We made a post that was also weirdly controversial on our Instagram page about... If you are a man who stays quiet in a room of other men when they are joking, making rape jokes, or misogynistic jokes, you're part of the problem.
Yeah.
If you are a white person in a room full of other white people where they're making comments like that or talking like that, it is your job to step in. We're not asking that you join in a march, right? Like, we're not asking that you put your life on the line. But your one small step for... fighting racism or fighting misogyny or fighting sexism can just be speaking up if you're the only one in the room.
And it's interesting that for me, when I've spoken up particularly about the use of the N-word, because I have called friends out on it a lot. And the one thing that people always want to ask me is, what about when you're listening to music and they say it? I say, I do not say it.
It's really easy not to say it.
Well, and this was something for me that was really hard. So when I was in the play Hair, I had a line where I had to say that word.
Right.
And there is a song called 3500 where that word is part of it.
Mm-hmm.
I refused to say it. I would not say it in rehearsals. I would not say it when we were running lines. I felt very uncomfortable. I felt this is not my word. This is not something that I can say. When I'm actually doing the show because it is impactful, I will say it because I am an actor and that's part of the script. I'll try to get past that. But our mentor who was in, like, the original cast was so, like, he, like, made fun of me for it. And it was really frustrating because I'm like... That's a personal choice for me. And then I have people who were like, oh, but we're bashing religion and I'm Catholic and, like, I don't mind. And I'm like, yeah, but this, for me, this is my line. Like, I will not say this unless I am performing it. I start saying the word in my line and then I'm stopped by Hud, who's the black character in the show. So I was like, I told him, I'm like, do not trick me into saying the whole thing. You better stop me once I start it.
Right. We're going to have a problem if that's what happens.
Like, don't think it's funny or cute for me to say the whole thing.
I have had conversations with you. I've had conversations on this podcast about the use of that word by white people and how I have had so many arguments with people. Either in person or online, who feel like they can say it and they don't understand why they're not allowed to. You're just not.
Yeah.
And I don't understand why.
Why do you have to say it? There's a million words in the world.
Right.
Like, you don't
have
to say it.
There's this one. That's a thing that is so interesting to me and something that really struck me when I was reading the comments on our Instagram post, where it's just like, there's only you're white. Mm-hmm. Like, there's only a handful of things you're not allowed to do mm-hmm. that you can really legitimately get in trouble for.
And there's one thing that they're like, oh my God, why can't I say it?
And when
why are you taking this away from me?
And when I say get in trouble for, I mean, you get a slap on the wrist by a person on the internet.
And you make somebody else feel really bad.
And you make someone else feel really bad. And, like, and whenever there are real life, actual physical life and death consequences for people of color, for all manner of things, you're going to get up in arms because I said your ancestor owned slaves? Like, you're going to get up in arms whenever I say you're not allowed to use the N-word, even if you're singing a Cardi B song? Like, really?
You know what I say instead? Neighbor.
Yeah.
Neighbor.
It's funny. Even though it's not the same number of syllables, Anthony always says Filipino.
I know. We talked about this before.
Funny.
Yeah.
But anyway, we've gotten off track. But
yeah,
I think
it was a really poignant thing in the movie for me.
And I think it all relates. I think it all goes back. And, you know, I am really raw from having dealt with this all day. But, like, I want to point out that, like, the arguments that I was having with people today, which I'm like, why did
I didn't
engage?
Even see your responses.
I didn't respond a lot.
Okay.
I responded a couple times, but like, or a lot of the arguments I was seeing were people being like, this is something that happened so long ago in regards to slavery and like, don't punish white people now for the things that our ancestors did.
But
and it's like,
but white
you
people
need to,
today are still
first of all
causing
that,
a lot of damage.
First of all that, and secondly, take a real hard look. We are talking about events that happened in 1965.
Exactly.
My mom was born in 1967.
My mom was born in 1951.
Right? My grandparents were fully realized adults at this point. Do not act as if slavery was the beginning and end
of racism.
Of the systematic disenfranchisement of Black Americans.
Agreed.
Because it was not. Slavery and slavery happened for a period of time. Jim Crow and segregation happened for a period of time. And then there's been mass incarceration. There's been other things
Murder.
That have happened that continue to happen up until this day. And they all go hand in hand. One would not exist without the other. So it's really frustrating for me to see people be like, well, that doesn't happen anymore, so racism doesn't exist.
I'm really sorry that you had to, like...
No, it's okay.
No, I know, but, like, it's one of those things that we have different reactions to both of those things. Clearly, it makes me very upset, but that's not my experience. So the way that both of us are going to react is going to be different because I realize that I can't truly empathize with what you go through mm-hmm. when you read those comments or when people say those things. I can stand up for that. I can do my very best to be an ally. But for me, I just feel nothing but, like, sorry and apologetic whenever I see it because it's so hard for me to see it when I can't fully console you
right.
or anybody else because I don't have that experience and that's okay. But it's hard because I don't know what to say all the time.
Yeah.
You know
yeah,
what I mean? But
I understand.
But it's hard it's hard for me to see other people getting hurt and especially knowing that you were so affected by the comments. I didn't even like seeing them. I can only imagine what it felt like for you.
Yeah. I think for me, I'm more disappointed in myself that, like, I allowed myself to get sucked in and respond at all. I think there's part of me, like...
Oh, that happens to me all the time on my page. I get sucked in a lot where I have to just be like, you know what? I'm not going to look at the comments
and
anymore.
That's what I had to do. I actually said to a person, I was like, I'm going to practice self-care and not look at your comments and not respond to you because...
Oh, I've gotten in so many... A lot... Mostly, like, comments about... like, lately, like, the gender roles posts we've made and things like that where I've gotten real heated about it and I'm like, you know what?
It's
for
not
my
worth
sake,
it.
I have to step back. You know,
right.
I've said, or I'll say like one or two comments and then step aside.
I think it hurts me because I'm just like, I cannot believe, and I can tell because you keep coming back that like you really believe this. And like, I look back to whenever I was ignorant and making really ignorant, whenever I was like very conservative and making
but
very...
if someone says something to you, you were like, oh my God, I didn't mean it. I'm so sorry.
No, back in the day when I truly believed like some ignorant ass shit, I got into like arguments with people about ignorant shit. And so I do think back about those and I was just like, I was so offended and like I fought so much. But now when I look back on them, I'm like, I am glad that somebody put me in my place though.
Agreed.
You know, so...
Oh, I've been put in my place a number of times, especially by Black friends and Black acquaintances.
And it hurts at the time, but then you're like, oh, I'm so glad you put me
but
in my
place.
But
for me, mostly it's been as an adult, and I never really feel hurt by it. I feel embarrassed.
Yeah.
because I've never ever said
anything. I feel embarrassed now.
That means to hurt somebody. So when I am called out on something and I see that somebody that I care about is hurt, I'm embarrassed.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
So I know you have more to say, but I found out more about the woman who was killed by the Ku Klux Klan. So if we want to talk about that done. Do you want me to say it now?
Let's just wrap up Selma real fast. Yeah, let's wrap it up
and then I'll talk about that.
So that August in 1965, so after the Selma March had completed, sorry guys, we went off on like a 10-minute tangent.
It's important. We're good.
But after the Selma March had completed in August of 1965, Congress passed the Voting Rights Act, which guaranteed the right to vote to all African Americans. And really, the right to vote, as we talked about for African Americans, as we talked about in our last full-length episode, was granted in the 15th Amendment for men and then for women with the passing of the 19th Amendment.
Yeah.
But this really did push that forward because it banned literacy tests as a requirement for voting and mandated federal oversight on voter registration in areas where tests were previously used.
Yeah.
And
his speech was televised nationally. It was considered to be a watershed moment for the civil rights movement. He said, "Even if we pass this bill, the battle will not be over. What happened in Selma is part of a larger movement which reaches into every section and state of America. It is the effort of American Negroes to secure for themselves the full blessings of American life. Their cause must be our cause, too, because it is not just Negroes, but really it is all of us who must overcome the crippling legacy of bigotry and injustice, and we shall overcome." So again, that was part of his speech from the televised after the Voting Rights Act. Again, I don't like saying Negroes either.
It's okay. We understand what you mean.
Okay.
So I do want to push home just as a final word on Selma. I want to push home that prior to the Voter Rights Act passing, only an estimated 23% of voting age blacks were registered nationally. But in 1969, that number jumped to 61%.
Yeah, it said by March 1966, nearly 11,000, and I don't like how Wikipedia words this, they just say blacks, which I don't like. 11,000 black people had registered to vote in Selma, where 12,000 white people were registered.
Yeah.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, so I mean, I think that really illustrates how much people wanted the ability to vote and just weren't able to have that.
Yeah.
So it wasn't laziness. It wasn't that they didn't want to vote. It wasn't, you know, a lack of effort on their part. It was lack of access and ability because that number jumped so dramatically in just a few years.
Yeah. So the woman who was murdered for her allyship was Viola Liuzzo. She was a white mother from Detroit. She had come to Alabama to support voting rights for black people. She was assassinated by the Ku Klux Klan members while she was ferrying marchers back to Selma from Montgomery. And something that was interesting to me, though, about the movie stating her at the end of it, it seemed out of place.
I felt the same way when I watched it.
Okay.
I did, too.
Because I wanted to say who she was because I feel like she did something really great, but she was not a part of the story.
I feel like she deserves a separate story.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, but they say afterwards the FBI's COINTELPRO operation spread false rumors that Liuzzo was a member of the Communist Party and had abandoned her children to have sexual relationships with African-American activists.
Oh, my God.
Clutch your pearls.
How dare she?
How dare she?
Yeah, African-Americans.
African-Americans, don't say it.
Oh my God.
My goodness. Yeah, it was weird. Like, I'm glad that, like, they said it because I wanted to know more about that person, but I was kind of like, this person had not one line in the entire movie.
Mm-hmm.
You show her once at the end, and you say this little blurb about her when there was so many people in that movie that I want to know more about what happened to them afterwards.
Yes.
Why is this one person talked about?
It is interesting. Like, it's an interesting choice.
Good story, but why?
Yeah,
why?
I feel like that movie was so well directed in so many ways, but that was a strange choice.
That was really
and
weird.
I want to know more about her. I would love for one of us to do her for a Forgotten Feminist Fade.
I would really like to talk about her sometime.
I think that that'd be fantastic.
But yeah, it did seem really out of place, especially because of, like, one thing that we talk about a lot when we are talking about allyship is that it's important for the other group to have their voice and to speak and to let them finish. Where there was something jarring about, like, kind of throwing a white person in there and being
at
like,
the end,
this happened to her too.
The conclusion be about, like, her story. I feel the same way.
It was weird. I feel like if she had been more of a part of the story, that it would have made more sense.
Right.
But she had nothing to do with that particular story that they were telling. Because there's a lot of other activists that were part of that story in some way, shape, or form that we talk about that didn't get little excerpts at the end. They didn't show Rosa Parks and say she boycotted
the
buses in Montgomery.
That's interesting.
There wasn't any other activists that were blurbed randomly at the end of the movie. So I just found that really jarring. But, you know, great example of allyship, but why?
Yeah, agreed. Interesting.
You know, let the people who are supposed to talk have the final word.
Have their moment.
You know?
Yeah.
Let them have it.
So
I don't mean let them have it, like, oh, just let them have it. Sorry, that probably sounded really
just
wrong.
Just toss them a bone.
I couldn't mean it that way.
No, I know you didn't.
Okay, good.
I know you didn't.
As soon as I said it, I was like, ooh, that sounds bad. Okay.
So, guys, go watch. I think Selma Lord Selma is on YouTube. Like, you should watch it. It's a good movie.
Yeah.
Watch
Selma.
Selma is a better movie.
The portrayals, the acting in that movie, I mean,
amazing.
I loved Coretta King's character. I loved the scenes of them when they're getting the really hateful phone calls and she's worried about her children. You know, the thing that's really powerful about any of these biopic movies is that it's really humanizing these historical figures that we've learned so much about, but showing some of their downfalls, some of the ugliness in their lives that I think is so important
to see. They weren't perfect people. You know, Martin Luther King Jr. was not a perfect man. He was not a perfect husband.
No, he wasn't. And they showed a lot of, I mean, they right off the bat, they were like, let's go after the wife because there's issues in the marriage. That's nothing I'd ever heard of before.
Right, right. I mean,
you know, I mean,
literally,
I heard about it before today, but.
Yeah, I mean, Martin Luther King Jr. had affairs. It's true. Like, and it's not something that we ever want to hear about our heroes, but he was a human being, a human man, and he wasn't perfect in every single way.
And like you said, too, a lot of people believe that the white community really liked him. Where
not the truth.
It's not the truth. And it's showing the backlash and the danger and the fear
they
had.
The FBI tried to assassinate him.
Exactly. Like, the fear that they had for his children and his family and, like, anyone who was associated with him. They were bugged. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, there's a lot of fear. And so I feel like showing the real raw reality of his life, I think, is really important. And showing the reality of his wife's life and the people who were around him, I think, is really important because those are parts of history that is brushed over when we talk about Black History Month. Black History Month is very much like an idyllic, perfect world scenario kind of teaching moment. You know what I mean? Malcolm X is painted in a very different light. Martin Luther King Jr. is painted in a very different light. Rosa Parks, we forget a lot of people when we talk about the history of these things. When we talked about Rosa Parks, we forgot about all the other people who had made these monumental movements within this movement.
Well, I mean, and we talk about Selma, right? And I think when people think of Selma, they think of Martin Luther King.
Yeah.
They don't think of Jimmie Lee Jackson. Do you know what I mean?
And like John Lewis.
And all of these other figures who literally put their lives at risk. They don't think of what it must have been like, as empowering as it must have been like to participate in this march.
How fucking
scary. How scary. Right? Like, you stood a very real chance of either being arrested or
dying.
I mean, and I can't remember, by the end of February, it was some kind of crazy number. I'll try and correct this if I can remember, but off the top of my head, I want to say it was something like 300 people by the end of February from this march were imprisoned. Like,
yeah.
Because they were just...
Yeah, I believe that sounds right from
it's
what I've read,
it's something like that, and... So I think we really need to look at the reality of the situation. It wasn't something that was glamorous, and we can look back now and be like, yeah, John Lewis, like, participated in this march, and that's amazing, and, like, yes, it is, but think of the reality of what being a 20-something man, Black man, in the South, and leading this number of people...
Potentially to their death.
Yeah. Potentially to your own death.
Yeah.
Would have felt like and been like,
it's a
it
large
would have
weight.
Been really scary.
It's a large weight to carry.
So, yeah, I mean, guys, watch Selma Lord Selma. Tell me if it's a bad movie, because my 8-year-old recollection is that it's wonderful. I should rewatch it as an adult because I'll probably be like, yikes, I need to take back that endorsement.
I want
to
watch it.
But yeah, I hope you enjoyed this episode. I know we did cover a lot. We also went off the rails a little bit.
But I think it's important to talk about how these things are still happening today and how they are affecting our lives today.
Yeah.
I think it would be doing a disservice if we just talked about what happened back then and how it doesn't
relate
to what's happening now.
And everything's fine now.
Yeah, everything's good. Racism is a thing of the past.
Yeah, you know? Totally.
So, all fixed, all done.
All done.
Closing my iPad, we're done. We solved racism. Just kidding.
Good job. We did it.
Not at all.
We're like Starbucks. So,
and Pepsi.
Can I
be Kendall Jenner?
If you have anything that you think that we should cover in Black History Month, we have two more episodes to go. I think we're going to do a Forgotten Feminist Fave next week.
Yeah, if you have ideas for us, shoot them our way.
But yeah, we're always down to take more ideas. We're also going to be going into Women's History Month for March. So if there's anything or anyone you want us to cover for Women's History Month, please shoot us an email at neighborhoodfeminist@gmail.com. You can join us for the madness on Instagram. It's a crazy
place. Join the party, guys.
Join the party. If it sounds like fun, if you want to get in and do the emotional labor so I don't have to.
Oh my god, please. I'm always like, please have someone say it because I don't have the energy.
When our listeners step in, it makes me feel so much better.
Yeah.
But you can get in on that at Angry Neighborhood Feminist on Instagram. You can also DM us with any ideas you have. Please also keep submitting your pets for Feminist Pet Friday. We had such a good time doing.
I'm going to be putting up my new puppy, Penny Lane.
Yeah, so that should be up already because this episode's going to come out on Monday.
Yeah, check her out. She's so cute.
So definitely send us your pets for Feminist Pet Friday. We love getting your pets. It's so much fun. It's so cute.
That's like every pet Instagram is like so famous because everybody loves to look at cute animals.
No, because it doesn't matter. Every animal is a cute animal.
Exactly.
Like, even if they're an ugly animal, they're a cute animal.
I know.
You can also follow us on Twitter if you want to. That is Yamf Podcast, Podcast, Madigan.
Sorry, I was reading Instagram comments.
Where is my echo?
I'm sorry. Wait, let's do it again.
Okay.
You can follow us on Twitter. Say it.
At Yamf Podcast, YANF Podcast. Thank you very much.
I'm the worst.
Okay. We also have a Facebook business page and Facebook group. So you can leave us reviews on our business page or you can rate and review us on Apple Podcasts.
You should totally do it.
Please.
It's so much fun. You're going to get such a rush.
Do it. Ooh. Oh my gosh. And when we feature you on Reviews Day Tuesday, oh my God.
You're going to be like a movie star.
I'm going to freak out.
All of your friends are going to call you on the phone and be like, oh my God, did you see?
So fancy.
So fancy.
The fanciest.
God, I need sleep.
Yeah. Is that everything?
I think so.
Okay.
You guys, with all that being said, we encourage you
to rage on.
Bye.